Welcome, friends, to another edition of Economic Update, a weekly analysis of major economic events and trends, the forces, both national and international, that shape our economic situations. What we spend, what we save, what we invest, our incomes, our jobs, all of it. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life at several different universities. Currently, I teach in the graduate program for international affairs at the New School University in New York City. I also write columns for truthout.org, a remarkable independent source of news and analysis. Check them out at truthout.org. If you're interested in the analyses we offer on this program, to try, as we do, to provide economic analysis across the board, then you will get benefits from visiting our websites, where we post all kinds of additional materials, copies of lectures that I give, research that we do. You can find it all at no cost whatsoever at both our websites, rdwolf.com and democracyatwork.info. Both of those websites are available to you. Both of those websites will allow you to sign up for the free newsletter we send to interested listeners and viewers of this program. And both websites, rdwolf.com and democracyatwork.info, enable you to send us your comments, criticisms, and questions, all of which we read and all of which we use to shape these programs, including towards the end, responding to one or two of the questions we select. Please be patient. We cannot possibly answer all of the communications that come to us and for which we are grateful. We have to select a few, and we try to do that by clumping them together, that is, trying to respond to questions that several of you have sent to us. And finally, please remember to follow me, Richard Wolff, on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest. Let's turn to updates today, and we'll begin with one that I owe to a listener. That listener responded to last week's discussion of a serious problem with insecticides that have been found to be dangerous for bees, so that in Europe there have been serious actions taken against these pesticides, because not only do they destroy bees, apparently, with all kinds of bad effects on crops, but also they can have bad effects on humans. And this listener sent in some material, which I checked, and which is correct, and which says there's another example, and this listener wanted me to bring it to your attention. It has to do with an action by the United States Food and Drug Administration questioning antibacterial soaps. These are now widely sold and used around the world, and they contain a chemical, actually two chemicals, triclosan and triclocarbon. And these may carry unnecessary risks, given that their benefits are unproven. That's a quotation from the Food and Drug Administration. So please be careful when you use or consider using antibacterial soaps, because the same issue has arisen. The chemical companies that make these chemicals have made a lot of money by convincing the public to want them and therefore the soap companies to use them. Now, it turns out, there may be serious questions, which, surprisingly, the chemical companies had no idea about. And they now don't want there to be any action. They want to use the 180-day wait period. They want to have a year to check out the research. Notice again that the profit-driven businesses are slow and want to postpone action. It's the government charged with our safety that is in a bit of a rush. And we ought to wonder which way we ought to tilt as a population, towards what's profitable for the chemical companies or towards what's more likely to be safe for ourselves. And if we're not happy being forced to make that kind of choice, we ought to wonder about why we would allow profit-driven entities to be in charge of something that affects our health in the first place. I want to turn to another update, this one having to do with the Republic of South Africa. something happened in their economy that I think is not only important for them, but has ramifications for virtually all countries. The largest trade union in South Africa, and indeed the largest trade union by membership in all of Africa, is something called the National Union of Metal Workers of South Africa, listed in the press as having 338,000 members. It has long been a part of the coalition that fought against apartheid in South Africa, together with the African National Congress, the ANC, and the South African Communist Party, currently partners in government of that society, the coalition led by Nelson Mandela, who recently passed and about whom much has been written and spoken. What is very interesting is that this largest trade union has finally, after 10 days of mourning in South Africa in honor of the passing of Nelson Mandela, this union has now withdrawn its support for the ANC, the party of Mandela. And it explained why it has done that. In light of the fact that the gap between rich and poor in South Africa is as bad or worse than it ever was, including under apartheid, and given the fact that the hope for a massive transformation of the South African economy did not materialize even after apartheid was ended, and that the current government is unable or unwilling to push through such a transformation, the National Union of Metal Workers of South Africa, 338,000 strong, has withdrawn its support for the government and announced that it's planning to start a socialist party in South Africa committed to protecting the interests of the working class. It is interesting for everyone to think about what it might mean for trade unions committed to protecting the interests of the working class to have made that kind of political decision in that country and what that might suggest in and for other countries. Okay. Next update. A remarkable development in Germany. And again, I talk about it because it is already happening in other countries and will undoubtedly happen before. So let's first begin. Germany, which in many ways provides by far the largest and most generous collection of public services for the citizens of that country, of any country in the world. It is extraordinary. I like to remind folks of the generosity of the German government in providing for its people, because it is interesting to note that Germany is also that country among all developed industrial countries that has been damaged least by the global economic crisis, whose unemployment today is markedly lower than it was in 2007, whereas the opposite is the case in virtually all other advanced industrial countries, certainly including the United States. In other words, Germany is a constant example of how the provision of social services to your people does not only not make you less competitive in the world, but is perfectly consistent with a country that is among the most competitive in the world and has therefore come through this crisis far better than countries like the United States and Britain, who do not provide social benefits, anything like that, that the Germans do. Well, here's an example. Germany provides long-term care for its people as a matter of right. And basically, it provides about half the cost of long-term care in a German nursing home or long-term care facility. And the Germans have an interesting arrangement. They provide twice as much if you get your long-term care inside Germany, but they will also provide about half that amount if you get and choose to get your long-term care outside of Germany. Now, why do I tell you this? Because an increasing number of Germans are willing and indeed choosing to retire into long-term care facilities when they need them that are located outside of Germany. And in particular, the country that has so far collected most of them is Poland, a neighbor of Germany to the east. But other countries are increasingly getting interested. For Poland, this is becoming an important industry. Polish long-term care facilities are discovering that they can become hosts to a client of German expatriates, whose payment of a portion of the fee from their own government is, in the lower price realm of Poland, more than enough to give these Germans the ability to pay for the facility in Poland and have a good bit of cash left over, something they could not do in Germany. Even though inside Germany the government pays half, still the other half is enough to absorb most of what older folks have to spend for all of this. Needless to say, Germans are not required to rely alone on the costs of long-term care. So what's happening? Something that used to be thought as a native industry that can't be exported turns out to be exported. Basically, a service sector providing the care for elderly people is now being done outside of Germany. And here's an example in which German private money and German government money is flowing out of the country, paying the fees that have to be paid for the services to be rendered in Poland to Germans who have retired there. A recent poll in Germany indicates that more than 1 in 5 Germans are more than happy to save the money and thereby retire with other Germans to such facilities outside the country. Question: in Western societies where the population is aging quickly, do we face yet another economic issue as more and more old people decide that they're going to retire where it's more affordable? So just as we make our shirts and our shoes and our appliances outside the United States, in China and India, now increasingly we're going to be seeing services also provided abroad, produced abroad and provided abroad, only in this case the service isn't brought back to the metropolitan country, the home country of this story. Rather, the elderly in Western Europe and North America and Japan will be traveling to the areas where they can buy it more cheaply. The economic effects of this can be profound and need to be watched. Final update for today has to do with something we hear a good bit about, particularly at this time of year. And this has to do with charitable donations by wealthy people. And one of them caught my eye that I want to share with you. It was a gift announced this last week by the financier Ronald O. Perlman. He's the man associated most popularly or most widely with the Revlon Cosmetics Company, although he has owned and operated many different companies. Basically, his business is buying and selling companies at a profit, and it has been very profitable for him. So he decided last week to give $50 million, no small change that, $50 million to a hospital in New York City, Langone New York University Emergency Department in particular. He had seen the troubles that hospital had during the Hurricane Sandy disaster here in New York City, and he was upset that another hospital in Lower Manhattan, St. Vincent's, had recently closed, part of the closing of hospitals across the country, and he understood that emergency care was becoming more and more important to tens of thousands of people. So he decided, in his mind, that he would take $50 million of his own money. He's worth in the billions, so this is not a major distribution for him. And he would give it to this hospital. I checked into Mr. Perlman's wealth. $14 billion is what I heard. 26th richest American, 69th richest person in the world. Well, much celebration has occasioned this contribution to the hospital. So while I understand the hospital is happy, and I can see why. I'd like to bring something to everyone's attention if it hasn't been brought before. Is it really appropriate for our healthcare services to be dependent for the quality of healthcare they provide to us on whether or not this or that wealthy person happens to find it convenient, attractive, and fun to give money? What kind of a health system makes itself dependent for the quality of service it delivers on the individual predilections and preferences of billionaires? Is that really appropriate? How can one person be allowed to have the power to either give or not give the means for quality health care? I mean, either that's a right of everybody, either that's something we give one another as members of a community because we can all need it at any time in our lives, or we don't. But it is a very bizarre to make the quality of our health care dependent on the whims of billionaires. Let me say the same thing in another way. The huge profits that are collected in the hands of Ronald O. Perlman are, after all, the result of all the companies he owns. In those companies, tens, hundreds of thousands of people work every day and produce the goods and services those companies sell. They therefore help to produce the profits those companies earn. And the profits are what Mr. Perlman is using to support this or that hospital, or maybe this year not a hospital and a museum, or maybe next year not a museum but a castle in Spain. Who knows? All of those people help to produce the profits. And if those profits are going to help take care of the medical care system, then all those people should be involved in deciding what is to be done with their profits. Like, for example, making sure health care is good for everybody, across the board, around the nation. It shouldn't be left in the hands of a tiny number of people who make the decision all by themselves without any regard whatsoever for what all the people who have to live with how they distribute their money, what all they think and what all of them need. It's an extraordinary way to handle health care in our system. As bizarre and dysfunctional, if you think about it, as any of the government activities that are in the news so much these days. Let me turn next to the major discussions for today's program. I have several, and I'm going to start with one that's in the news a great deal, and that is the Affordable Care Act, sometimes known as Obamacare, and all the noise that has been circulating around the country about how the rollout in the computer arrangements for signing up have been botched, which they clearly have, that all kinds of people are encountering difficulty understanding or signing up for this program, and that's clearly what has happened. And finally, and for me the most telling, the enormous extra costs that are being foisted on millions of Americans who had hoped and expected from what they were told that the Affordable Care Act, given its name, would make healthcare more affordable, not less. Let me give you an example of some of the things that have come across my desk over the last week. In Alabama, premiums have doubled for middle-class families in many parts of the state. People are screaming. They don't know what to do or how to manage it. In Tennessee, Senator Lamar Alexander, admittedly a Republican, issued a report indicating how many of the people in his state, Memphis, Nashville, and so on, are encountering higher costs for their doctors, their hospitals, their medical devices, and their insurance. In the state of Washington, as in the states of Texas, Florida, New York, Illinois, Georgia, and North Carolina, similar reports of rising costs, particularly of health insurance, which is spiraling out of control. What are we to make of this? Is this a technical glitch of the planners that Obama put in charge? I don't think so. Is this a detail of management that will quickly be corrected? I don't think so either. There's something deeper going on here, and that's what I want to focus on with all of you today, briefly. We had an opportunity in the United States with the Affordable Care Act and with a president like Obama to actually catch up to the other advanced industrial countries of the world, every one of whom has a national system of health insurance and a national system of delivery of care. In all of those examples, the state plays a major role. And in all of those examples, the power of the following four industries is much more limited than it is in the United States. Those industries are doctors, number one, hospitals, number two, the makers of drugs and medical devices, number three, and the medical insurance companies, number four. In many other countries, those companies exist, but they are subordinated in key ways to a national government committed to providing national health care to their people at an affordable cost. The end result is that in every other country, advanced industrial country like us, other than the United States, the total amount of spending on health care is half or less what we spend in the United States. In other words, they succeed at controlling their medical costs because of the system of a close partnership between a dominant government and a subordinate private capitalist sector. We don't do that in this country. We subordinate the government, as I will explain, to the private companies. We reverse it. And here are the results. We spend twice as much as a population on medical care compared to every other advanced industrial country, and in many cases, more than twice as much. Our medical results are mediocre, not as good as many of those countries that spend far less. And by medical results, I mean how long we live, the non-communicable diseases that we have as a population, obesity, diabetes, and so on, by the number of children who make it through the first year of life, by the number of days per person we spend in hospitals, all of the usual measures, the United States is in the middle, mediocre at best, but we spend twice as much as everybody else. Why? And here comes the punchline. Because the Affordable Care Act and President Obama, it has to be said, chose not to go the route pioneered by all those other countries, not to learn from their experience, not to adapt the model of a successful program they have had in many cases for decades, with the time, therefore, to work out the problems and to streamline the operation. We could have borrowed, we could have copied, we could have accommodated, we could have adjusted, we didn't. We chose instead to have a gerrymandered bill, half written by the very companies that need to be controlled, doctors, hospitals, drug and device makers, and insurers. With the end result, they all got into that bill the provisions that would allow them to slither through, to escape the control by acting before the 1st of January 2014, or by utilizing this loophole, or by changing this price in order to arrange the other one. Bottom line, they took care of themselves. They held on to the 18% of GDP we spend in this country on health care. They made sure that Obamacare couldn't deliver on what Americans need most, which is better care at a lower price. What's actually happening is poorer care at a higher price. And once again, the screaming message that this ought to leave in the American public is, you've allowed your medical care system to be taken over by a medical industrial complex. a carefully orchestrated game in which doctors, hospitals, drug and device makers, and medical insurers cut a deal amongst themselves to rip the rest of society off on a scale that is stunning. And the only thing more impressive than what they've been able to do in the drive to profit has been the willingness of the American people to tolerate it. Over the last week, another scandal. By now it's becoming tiresome. Another scandal for whom? For the large banks in the United States. Oh, old story, you say. Well, indeed. The story is older still. What bank is involved? You guessed it. J.P. Morgan Chase, a culprit now on one scandal after another, involved in the mortgage finagling scandals, involved in the LIBOR scandals in England, involved in money laundering and fee gouging. What's the latest one? The latest one seems to have been an exception the J.P. Morgan company got from the Federal Reserve. I won't speculate on how they managed that, but it has to do with the 1999 decisions in Congress to allow large banks to go beyond the normal banking business and buy and sell certain commodities. Oh, the argument was made this would make the markets in these commodities work more efficiently. There are always economists available for hire who will make that kind of very convenient prediction, usually very well paid by the companies that want those predictions to be made. But now, guess what? The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission last week discovered that J.P. Morgan has inappropriately manipulated the market in electricity. I can't do better than read from the story by Gretchen Morgenson, an excellent economics writer in the New York Times, on Sunday, December 22nd. I quote, J.P. Morgan traders began a scheme to manipulate electricity prices, ultimately forcing consumers in regions to pay more every time they flicked on a light switch or an air conditioner. That's what the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission subsequently contended. I could read you more, but the basic story is the same. Driven by the competition among major banks, J.P. Morgan, Citibank, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, you know the names. Driven by their competition to get in on all these financing deals, they're always pushing the envelope. What envelope? The envelope of what's ethical, what's decent, what's legal in varying combinations. And now they got caught at yet another effort so outrageous that the government that allows them to do it has found that they have misused that allowance. They haven't made the market more efficient. They've lined their own pockets. I don't just bring this up to tell another story to an old tale of bank corruption, bank exploitation of the entire society, indeed the entire world. That's by now a familiar story. I bring it up because I want to hammer at a basic point. If any public activity had the record of immoral, unethical, illegal abuse of its power and positions, there would have been howls to demand the privatization of such an activity. The government, it would have been said, has no right to do that if it does such a horrible job. But here we watch an industry, the banking, the big banks, not the little community banks, the big ones located in the capitals with trillions or billions in their hands. We're seeing a pattern of immoral, unethical, and or illegal behavior that's literally stunning. And yet we live in a society which can't dare ask the question, why do we allow private enterprise, profit-driven enterprise? when the outcome is as disastrous as this. At the very least, we ought to have an alternative to this. And I'm going to go on with that in a moment. We're going to take our break, and then I'll give you an example of a non-bank that is behaving in the same way to drive home that the ultimate problem is profit-driven capitalist enterprise. And then I'm going to give you some suggestions for how we could do better than this. Stay with me. We'll take our normal program break at this time. This is Economic Update. I'm Richard Wolff. Talk to you again in a few seconds.
Grandma's hands clapped in church on Sunday morning. Grandma's hands played a tambourine so well. Grandma's hands used to issue out a warning. She'd say, Billy, don't you run so fast. Might fall on a piece of glass. Might be snakes there in that grass. Grandma's hands. Soothe the local unwed mother. Grandma's hand used to ache sometimes and swell. Grandma's hand used to lift her face and tell her she'd say, baby, Grandma, understand that you really love that man. Put yourself in Jesus' hand, Grandma's hand. Used to hand me a piece of candy. Grandma's hand picked me up each time I fell. Grandma's hand, boy, they really came in a handy. She'd say, Matty, don't you whip that boy. What you wanna spank him for? He didn't drop no apple core, but I don't have Grandma anymore. If I get to heaven, I'll look for Grandma's hand.
Welcome back. This is Economic Update. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. As usual, I want to remind you that as we go through today's program, you can always supplement your understandings, your access to documents, your pursuit of these kinds of analyses, by simply going to either of our two websites, rdwolf.com or democracyatwork.info. Both of those websites have materials. Both of them are completely free for your access 24/7. And both of them provide ways for you to communicate with us, your thoughts, your questions, your suggestions, and your criticisms. All are welcome. And I guarantee we will read each and every one of them. And finally, do remember to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest. Before the break, we were discussing banks. I now want to talk about another kind of financial corporation because it is in the news. It has been caught out for its bad behavior. And so it takes us again into that territory of shaking our heads in wonderment that we have a private capitalist big bank sector when it has so badly performed, so badly abused the public trust. Over the last week, a settlement was reached between the Ocwen, and I'll spell it for you, Ocwen Financial Corporation, O-C-W-E-N, if you're interested in learning more about it. It reached a settlement with the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau in Washington. Indeed, the settlement was partly with that bureau in Washington and partly with attorneys general in 49 out of the 50 states. So here's a company that pays out, this was the settlement, $2.2 billion with a B. That's a lot of money. This company paid $2.2 billion as a settlement with the federal government and 49 out of the 50 states. Now, this is not a bank. So it's not like the other 25 billion in settlements that big banks arrived at over the last year or two for their various misdeeds. This is a company that services mortgages. That means it's the company that collects the monthly mortgage payments people make, decides who's supposed to get each portion of that, ships it out to those who have it, supervises, prosecutes those people who can't pay anymore, handles legal dimensions of it, and so on. They got caught up, of course, in the crisis in 2007 and 8. But starting in 2009, they began to be very profitable indeed, as all of the mortgages that were in trouble, and even those that weren't, had to be handled, and the banks got their fingers burnt because they had been doing it so poorly. So, for example, the stock in this mortgage handling company, Ocwen Financial Corporation, has risen since 2009 by 500%. Good company to have been invested in. And when the announcement was made last week that they have to pay $2.2 billion, which, by the way, some in the media said was a really serious blow to the company and really will make them mend their ways. Here is what investors did on the day the settlement was announced. Did they think that this was going to be a really costly penalty to the company? Did they think that the company would now mend its ways and therefore be less profitable? No. Here's how much the stock fell on the day that the $2.2 billion settlement was announced. 1.9%. So from 2009 to last week, it went up 500%. And when this penalty was announced, it dropped 1.9%, as against going up 500%. Do you think the investors thought this was a serious blow to the company? Obviously not. Worse, people are already complaining about this settlement that it is like all the others. Namely, it leaves the banks themselves in control of how this money gets doled out, when this money gets doled out, and to whom it gets doled out, with the result that there are enormous complaints of people who say their rights have been trampled, the money owed them has not been paid. In the case of the Ocwen financial statement, we have the lovely calculation by the official in charge of getting the settlement in Florida that when you work out the amount of money that will actually be paid, not to those people that are facing the risk of foreclosure, that's the bulk of the money, but the people who've already lost their homes. Out of the Ocwen Financial Corporation, all the people who lost their homes through the behavior of Ocwen, among other things, they will get a settlement, having lost their home, roughly equal to $1,200 per family. I'm almost speechless at that thought. You've driven a family out of their home. They've lost all the money they poured into that house for however many years they've left in it. They are now either homeless or reduced to renting. And they're going to get a settlement that gives them $1,200 to compensate them for the loss of their home. What possibly can be added to that? Well, where does this leave us, other than outraged? I think it leads us to consider what the alternatives might be to having major banks like J.P. Morgan or huge financial corporations like Ocwen Financial. We ought to have alternatives to them. And let me give you several ideas for alternatives that have either been practiced in one or another country in the past, or that suggest themselves by the sheer logic of the situation, or already exist in the United States and simply need to be taken further, because all of those are offering alternatives. So let's begin. First and obviously, the government could and should set up its own bank to handle these settlements, with the costs of administering this settlement to be paid for by the bank whose misbehavior led to the settlements in the first place. In other words, these companies ought at the very least to pay the costs of cleaning up the mess their immoral, unethical, and or illegal activities caused. But they shouldn't be allowed to control or administer it because their inadequacy, their inappropriateness for doing that has already been demonstrated by them at great length and in stupefying detail. So the government ought to have a bank that does that, administers these settlements, and the expense borne by the banks and financial corporations that did it. Why in the world is this not pursued as a preferable alternative that would work better and cost the taxpayer less? I leave it to you to guess why that alternative is not even being discussed. Second alternative. There ought to be a government bank in the banking business. We ought to have a bank that provides mortgages to people, handles credit cards, makes loans to businesses, and so on. Why? Because a government bank that did that would be a competitor to the private banks that are now doing it. The Wells Fargo's, the Bank of America's, the Citibank's, the J.P. Morgan, and so on. Those banks say they believe in competition, but they're afraid of government competition. They're afraid of a bank competing with them that would have to be transparent in the way they are not, that would have to be subject to direct political oversight by our elected representatives, which they are not. And guess what? If we took that step, we would have a benchmark, a standard for what a federal bank could do that would make all of the others shape up, match that, or worry that they would lose business. If competition sharpens everybody's behavior, as those who support competition would like to have us believe, then they ought to put up or shut up. Put the government in a competitive situation, and let's see how that works. Of course, to ensure transparency, setting up a government bank would have to be done in a different way from what has been our past experiments with that kind of thing. It would have to be a bank in which all of the workers, the clerks, the tellers, the loan officers, all participate in running the bank. It should be a cooperative bank, because with that many people involved and that many people having access to all the documents, it would be much harder to engage in the kinds of shenanigans that we know every private capitalist bank of any size and every private capitalist financial corporation has been deeply involved in. Third alternative, let's borrow from the Bank of North Dakota. Here in the United States, for 100 years, this bank has been the place where the state of North Dakota deposits all the monies flowing into the state. The taxes paid by individuals, the taxes paid by corporations, the dog license and hunting license and fishing license and motor vehicle registrations that are paid by people. That money flowing into the state is deposited in a bank that's owned and operated by the state, that makes sure to make loans to the people in the state, and that takes all the profits from its banking activities and gives them back to the state so it can tax its people less, since it needs less money from the people, since it gets it from the profits of its own bank. If it has worked real well for 100 years in North Dakota, and it has, and if it has resisted the efforts of Republicans and conservatives to get rid of it, and the efforts of private big banks to get rid of it, then it has passed the test of time. And if it worked for the folks in North Dakota, who knows what it might do for the other states and for the nation as a whole? Come on. The Bank of North Dakota didn't collapse in the Great Crisis. They didn't lend riskily. They didn't participate in credit default swaps. They were the right bank at the right time. If we don't see in them a model and an alternative that can at least be explored, then there's something holding us back from the rational response to the malfeasance of our private capitalist banks. Finally, another movement that has arisen here in New York City and maybe in other parts of the country as well. And it has this kind of hybrid idea. What about a city like New York taking its money and instead of depositing it in the big banks that have cost the city staggeringly by their illegal, immoral, and or unethical behavior for which they're paying these settlements, instead of giving you the money, the huge billions that the city of New York collects, put it in the credit unions. So if you don't want to set up your own bank, go at least to the kinds of relatively transparent, relatively democratic institutions where people pool their own money to provide credit to themselves outside of a private capitalist banking system, the credit unions. Municipal employees already have them, and there are plenty of others. What about a city doing that and making sure that these credit unions will then use the money that the city deposits in them to do things that are good for the people of New York, which the credit unions already serve much more fairly and much more effectively than the private banks? Well, we've come to that part of the program where I have time for a few questions from you, my audience. And you've asked, and I'm interested in this, you've asked me to go back to something we used to do more often, which is talk about non-capitalist enterprises, enterprises that have been set up by people in America and other countries that want not to work in a capitalist enterprise. That is, they don't want to have a boss. They want to be their own boss. They don't want to have shareholders, people who don't live and work with the company but have the power simply because they have the wealth to own shares. They don't want that. They want enterprises that are owned and operated by themselves. They want to be their own boss, something I think most Americans understand instinctively and that many people around the world desire. So I'm going to give you two examples that we haven't spoken about before that have come to my attention recently, even though I want to assure everyone that there are thousands of these kinds of corporations and enterprises, democratic, worker-run, often worker-owned as well, around the world, including the United States. Well, here's the first one to talk about. It's called Nature's Bakery, and it exists in Wisconsin. It has existed for many, many years. It actually was born in the 1960s, so we're talking half a century of age. It involves a group of people who provide all kinds of food services. The bakery has branched out. It's been able to survive all these years because it is a successful enterprise. It provides a good living for the workers who collectively own and operate it. It has been able to compete successfully against conventionally, capitalistically organized bakeries. It is very, very successful. And I think that the folks in and around Madison, Wisconsin, would attest to the remarkable longevity. This is a cooperative business that has lasted longer than non-cooperative businesses typically do. And so it stands as a kind of proof positive of the viability and the possibility and the desirability of this kind of an enterprise. The other enterprise is newer. It's called the Green Broom Brigade. It opened in April of this year, and it involves environmentally green cleaning services, and it's located throughout Santa Barbara, California, Santa Barbara County in California. It's a group of women who offer cleaning services that are strictly environmentally sensitive. So they've found, these women, a way to deal with unemployment problems, poverty problems, by creating a business that fits a particular niche, people who want cleaning services, businesses who want cleaning services, but who want them to be nature-friendly, who want them to be sensitive. So it's the Green Broom Brigade. Small to begin with, but able to do a number of interesting things. A lot of customers signing up, very good news. They were able to get from their regional Lompoc Cooperative Development Project a grant of some thousands of dollars to help them get the capital to start. I mention that because of that kind of thing is available for other businesses as well that start up as co-ops. Many of you have asked me, where do you get the money to start? Well, it turns out many business development authorities all over the country have money that is available for co-ops if the people take the initiative to do it. I also want to address the question, well, these are small. Nature's Bakery in Wisconsin, the Green Broom Brigade in California are small. This is sometimes referred to by people skeptical about cooperative business as if there were something wrong or inappropriate about being small. The best way to refute that and to understand why it's incorrect as a way of thinking is that capitalism started small too. In the transition out of the previous system in Europe before capitalism, by the name feudalism, in the emergence of capitalism out of feudalism in the 15th, 16th century in Europe, guess what? All the early capitalist enterprises were small. A capitalist and three workers, or six workers, or nine workers. It took a long time, centuries in fact, for capitalist businesses to acquire the huge size we take for granted now. So the notion that co-ops, as they emerge out of capitalism, begin by emerging small is not a refutation or a criticism or even very germane to anything. That's how things often start. That's how capitalism started. And if you wonder, well, could the small co-op ever learn how to be big? Well, that's one of the reasons you hear on this program often about the Mondragon Cooperative Corporation in Spain, because its 100,000 workers prove that over the 50 years of its history, it was able to go from small to large, thank you very much. Did it have problems along the way? Of course it did, just as capitalism encountered all kinds of problems going from small to large. And, of course, the story will be different with co-op enterprises from what it was with capitalist enterprises. But there's no intrinsic problem whatsoever about being small when you start and getting large and solving problems along the way. Finally, for today, I wanted to respond to one of you who sent me in a very well-crafted email in which you basically said to me, look, I understand and appreciate your interest, speaking to me, in worker self-directed enterprises. Enterprises where workers democratically together make all the key decisions, become their own bosses. But isn't it true that if we follow California's Disclose Act and the federal equivalent of a Disclose Act, that we could establish the apparatus at state and federal levels to regulate and control the capitalist economy in the ways that were begun and suggested by Franklin Roosevelt, so that we could have a kind of positive, humane, human capitalism, one that didn't behave in the way we see around us today, a capitalism that really was regulated by a constitutional amendment or a differently organized Supreme Court, and that would be better. Let me respond briefly. I understand and I sympathize with a desire to make a capitalism that wasn't filled with the kinds of stories I report to you about week after week. and that you see in the newspaper and on TV week after week. I think it would be wonderful to have a democratically limited and controlled capitalism. I think it would be wonderful to have regulations that really worked. But the hard reality is, and we cannot escape the implications of this, that we have been there, we've tried that, and we haven't succeeded. The rules and regulations put into effect have been evaded by private capitalist corporations, weakened by private capitalist corporations, and in many cases, eventually eliminated. They don't last. The private corporations have every incentive to undo all of these limits on what they can do, and they collect into their hands the profits that give them the resources to achieve what they have every incentive to achieve. We can't go down that road again because we've tried it and it hasn't worked. That's why we need more basic change. That's why we need to reorganize our enterprises from the ground up. If we make a democratic enterprise, we can hope to have a democratic society. If we don't, it doesn't look to be possible. Thank you, as always, for your attention. This is Economic Update. I'm Richard Wolff. And I look forward to talking with you again next week.
Your time, not babe. But after a while, it's gonna be my time, babe. Thing gonna change. Change.